The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Tech Weekly with me, Alex Kratosky, back in London. And I'm joined by the rest of the team.
Charles Arthur.
Alex Hearn.
And Samuel Gibbs.
Always professional. This week, we will be exploring the tender, or should I say the Tinder, side of tech. Yes, with romance in the air, we'll be exploring the reality that matchmaking is a digital affair these days, with dating sites playing an ever greater role in getting hitched. Also, we'll be talking about one notable breakup this week. Sony's fallen out of love with the laptop business, a passion too far, as Flappy Birds becomes a huge global hit, then implodes, and then becomes an even greater gaming indie hit. And then we hear from Hugh Hancock, who's created the first World of Warcraft-based film. Yes, this is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Now, before we talk about amore, you see that? You like my Italian influence there? Let's get some of the heartbreak and breakups in the tech world out of the way. Of course, I'm talking about Sony's announcement this week that it's to sell off its Vaio laptop computer division along with Bravia, its TV set business. Charles, you think this is the beginning of a pruning for Sony?
Well, the company says that it's going to make a loss of $1.1 billion for the financial year, which runs to the end of March. And the problem is that neither the TV business nor the PC business is making money for it. And so it's spinning off the TV business into a subsidiary, a wholly owned subsidiary, and it's selling off the PC business to a Japanese private equity company. And the question is whether the private equity company can make any money out of making so many PCs. The indication is that it's going to withdraw from the rest of the world and just focus on Japan, where Sony has a strong brand, and just try to sell its PCs there. But you have to question what the future is for the rest of the PC business, really.
It's not just the future for the rest of the PC business. Let's sort of be a bit myopic on Sony's experience. This is something like the sixth year that they've announced a loss, which is quite extraordinary. How have they managed to stay afloat thus far? What is keeping them above water? What's the buoyancy in there?
The buoyancy is all the cash in the bank, really. But you can't keep on making losses and depreciating your stockpile and your cash pile. So, you know, something has to give. And getting rid of the PC business, finding a willing buyer there, is at least one step towards cutting a source of loss. And the question is now whether they can do the same in TVs. Once upon a time, Sony ruled the world when it came to TVs. You know, the Trinitron was a big name. But now the problem is that they have all the competitors in the form of LG and Samsung and China, where companies are churning them out. And it's very difficult to persuade people to buy a new TV, to buy a particular branded TV, when people like Samsung can offer you OLED TVs at the top end, and the Chinese companies can offer you, you know, cheap LED or LCD ones at the bottom end.
It's also worth pointing out that one of the other ways Sony has stayed afloat is Sony Financial Holdings. The company actually owns a life insurance business, a life assurance business, a bank and a securities firm, which accounts for over half its global earnings. The unit earned $1.7 billion profit in 2006, which is the last year I can find data for right now.
So it's not just, one of the things that I've heard that has been keeping them floating along is their content business, although they do create hardware with smartphones in partnership with other companies. It's mostly the games and the movies and the music studios, and now it seems like it's also the people's financial whims. Samuel,
I mean, Sony, the cutting and the reinvigoration of the business, this is not the first time we've seen it. Sir Howard Stringer was the first non-Japanese man to be brought in at the business, and his job was to basically turn the business around. He was brought in 2005 and immediately cut 9,000 jobs put greater integration between Sony's very separate siloed business units. He was one of the forging factors in the reinvigoration of Sony's entertainment business, which is one of the businesses that contributed to the success. I mean, for instance, it was apparently his fist that punched through the Spider-Man movie, for instance, which really got the blockbusters going for Sony, and Sony Pictures started making money again.
He had actually come from the film business. Let's say, you know, Howard Stringer had been running Sony's film business, and he was then promoted to the chief executive position, but yes, was the first non-Japanese ever to hold that position.
So, Charles, coming back to the PC business, as you mentioned, you know, you sort of alluded to the idea that it is imploding. What is the outlook for the PC business? And I know, Samuel, you have a few things to say about that. Oh my, that's quite a definitive gesture.
Okay. Well, the reality is that the number of PCs being sold is shrinking and has shrunk over the past 2 years. So Windows PC sales, so that's leaving out Apple sales in this, fell by 2.6% in 2012 and 11% in 2013. Apple sales in 2012 fell by 5%, but they were flat in 2013. So its share of the machines sold actually grew. A lot of people say, nah, the PC business isn't shrinking. It's just people are taking long before they replace them. Well, yes, that means that the installed base, the number of PCs in use in the world, is staying the same. That's absolutely the case. But because people take longer to replace them, the sales of PCs per year falls. And that means that the PC companies, the companies actually making the things, have a problem because their fixed costs, things like, you know, your factories, your distribution, all the people who do your marketing, those remain. But if you're not getting as much revenue in, then your fixed costs start to eat into your profits pretty quickly. And so the PC business generally, for Windows PC makers, is not very profitable. They make, you know, a few dollars, $15 or so tops in profit per PC. And it's also becoming more concentrated. So the big five PC makers, Lenovo, HD, HP, Dell, Asus, and Acer, make 60% of the PCs sold. Apple makes another 5%. It's actually the sixth biggest. And then you have a lot of, you know, frankly, sort of minnows who may or may not be making money, the sort of the Sonys, Samsungs, Toshibas, Fujitsus, NECs, those sorts of companies. And it's not being a great business for them. So Samsung, for example, is looking at doing Chromebooks because it's a bit cheaper. You can sell them about the same price as a Windows PC, but you don't have to pay for a Windows license.
The other thing which has really changed for Sony, especially its position in the PC market over the last 5 years, is that the ability and hope for having a business which works across divisions has just died with PCs. As everyone has moved their content onto services like Spotify, as social networks take a bigger role, as even cloud word processing starts gaining a foothold into normal people's lives, you end up with this situation where the ability of a Sony VAIO laptop to influence the purchase of a Sony Bravia television and then to work better with a PlayStation 4, it's just not there in the same way, or the hope isn't there in the same way that it was 5 years ago.
There's no ecosystem around a Windows PC in that sense. You can't say, oh yeah, I totally want to have a Sony PlayStation so that it can link to my Sony PC. You know, the thinking doesn't follow through there.
Well, thank you very much, Charles, Samuel, and Alex. And Samuel, you've been doing some really good work on the history of Sony, which you can see on The Guardian's website. That's theguardian.com/technology. It's the time of year when singletons and unhappy couples stare askance at pairs snuggling on the sidewalk. Red is the color of love, folks, and pink hearts lure people into shops to get their money so that they can buy their ways into someone else's thoughts. Okay, yes, perhaps I am cynical when it comes to Valentine's Day, but surely no more than the industries that are trying to encourage us to reduce our hormones and our heartstrings into ones and zeros for the purposes of finding a match. The Pew American Life Project has published a report this week about technology, social media, and relationships following on from their own research into finding love, published last year. And joining me down the line is that report's co-author, Amanda Leonard, senior researcher, director of teens and technology at Pew Internet. Welcome, Amanda. First of all, is this research relevant only to American couples?
Well, it certainly was conducted with an American population. So in that regard, it is certainly better representative of what Americans are thinking and doing and how they're behaving. But I would like to think that it does have some generalizability.
It's got an international element to it. And of course, in the UK, as I mentioned in the introduction, we
ourselves are sort of avid online daters. Now, that's not specifically the focus of this report. Your work that you're releasing this week is more about social media in couples, in existing relationships. But Pew did release a report on online dating and relationships quite recently. What were some of the headline findings there?
Well, on that report, we found that it was actually a follow-up on a report that we did in 2005, which was the first look that we'd ever done at online dating back in the earlier days. And we found, you know, not surprisingly, that a lot of attitudes towards online dating have really changed since 2005. A lot of the stigma that we heard about back then has really lifted. Most people are much more positive about it. Most people know someone who's met someone through online dating. So it's really become a much more normal part of most Americans' experiences. Even if they themselves haven't necessarily used it, they generally have some kind of contact and connection to it.
It seems as though online dating stories, it's almost obligatory to have a sort of horror story to go with the sort of, yes, I know someone that does it. I mean, you know, I have a friend who does it, and because her husband died, in fact, and you know, she has terrible horror stories about just the relentlessness of it. And equally, there was a guy on one of the forums who said, I posed as a woman on an online dating thing, and I was horrified. You know, he was just basically getting all sorts of unwanted messages all the time because they thought that they were female.
That was actually a great article, Charles. That was quite a horrifying insight into the experience of the different genders.
And we do actually see that in this report. So most online daters say they have largely positive opinions and experiences with the process, but almost at least half of them have some kind of negative experience to tell you. So about half say that they felt that somebody else has misrepresented themselves in their profile. About a quarter say that they've been contacted through a dating site or app in a way that made them felt harassed or uncomfortable, which is very much like that the gentleman who posed as a woman and had that experience. And of course, you know, as we find, women are more likely than men to say that they have these uncomfortable experiences.
I have to ask, was the half who complained, was that the women? You know, was that the actual, is that the 50% who are women users of dating? Actually, you know, and how does it break down? How does online dating break down? Is it sort of 50-50 women to men, or is it sort of 75-25 men to women, or what is it?
Well, certainly in the negative experiences, we see that it's heavily much more women. So 42% of online daters who are women have experienced some kind of harassing contact, as opposed to about 17% of men. So certainly, that's a, you know, I think that's, you know, we see a lot of things. We've had in the U.S. at least a lot of press around women, discussions around women being harassed online as well. So that's in some ways an extension of what might otherwise be a general female experience in some of these online forums and spaces for interaction. So it's not entirely surprising that that would be the experience. Nevertheless, you know, we do hear that for most people, and certainly for women, they're not necessarily scared away. We have so many people using this as a way of meeting new people.
Amanda, moving now to the subject of the next report, this current report, which is more about couples who are already in relationships. So mm-hmm. whether they've managed to get through the morass of online dating, or perhaps they started dating before online dating became something that was a viable or indeed a sort of socially acceptable phenomenon. How does technology help to facilitate the connectedness in relationships between couples?
Well, it has a couple of different elements. So there's the ways in which the technology kind of makes the logistics of your life a little bit easier. So, you know, we hear things that, like, for instance, about 1 in 10 married couples share an online calendar. About a quarter of married or partnered couples say that they share an email account. So in some ways, you know, technology, it depends on how you come to it. So of those couples who are sharing a lot of these online tools, we see that those are predominantly couples who have been together for more than a decade. So if you came to the technology as a unit, as a couple, you're a little bit more likely to use that technology together, whereas people who have been in shorter duration relationships who use the technology initially as sort of independent actors, they come, you know, they continue to use the technology a little bit more independently as they move forward in these relationships.
Well, actually, Amanda, you also found in this report that older couples will share social media accounts as well. So whether it's like a Facebook account, but they'll, you know, that's also quite intimate.
Yeah, absolutely. Social media profile sharing, it's 11% of couples say that they do that. And again, it's much more likely to be couples who came to the technology later, who came to technology together, as opposed to those who are independent.
Now, Amanda, where does technology get in the way of relationships, and how do people negotiate this?
It's actually, technology also has this element of both, I think, supporting intimacy, but also finding ways to sort of take away from it, and or at least create tension and difficulty in relationships. And we certainly heard about this in this report as well. Some of the sources of tension that technology users who are couples told us about included, for instance, about a quarter of cell phone owners who are in serious relationships, meaning they're married or partnered, have felt that their partner or spouse was distracted by the cell phone when they were together. About 8% of couples also say that they've reporting that they've had arguments or fights over the amount of time that one of them was spending online. So it's not just, you know, the technology itself. It becomes a source of tension and distraction. And in fact, you know, the activities but on the flip side of that, we also heard about couples using the technology as a way of increasing intimacy, as a way of diffusing tension, as a way of resolving arguments. So we had 9% of couples who say I resolved an argument with my partner that we couldn't resolve face to face. We were having difficulty, so we went into a text space. We used text messaging. We went online, and we were able to work through it. Others say that they've, you know, about 1 in 5 say that they've felt closer to their spouse or partner because of exchanges that they've had online or via text messaging, whether that's, you know, just a quick I love you and a text message in the middle of the day. So couples are using it in a bunch of ways. So it both contributes, I think, to this, to tension and to difficulty in relationships, but also can help unwind and unpack some of that.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Amanda. Couples, the Internet and Social Media is released this week. And Amanda, where can people download it from?
You can find it on our site at www.pewinternet.org.
Thank you, and great to speak.
Great. Thanks so much, guys.
Okay, the week that it is, obsession might describe your feelings for the focus of your desire. Freak. And if you're a Flappy Bird player, obsession seems to be the default setting. The indie smartphone game was created by Vietnamese designer Dong Nguyen, who was the last person to think he'd have a global hit on his hand. And in the frenzy of attention, seems to not have been able to take the pressure and pulled the game. But as Guardian Games editor Keith Stewart will tell us, this only made things worse. Keith joins us down the line for an update on this. Keith, first.
Hi, Alex.
Flappy Bird. I missed that. What happened? I blinked. What is it?
Well, it's all happened remarkably quickly, I think. It's only really been in the last month, but it's essentially a kind of a deceptively simple iPhone game in which you control a bird that's got to navigate a series of gaps in pipes. And to navigate, you have to keep pressing the screen to make your bird's wings flap and to gain height. So you're constantly having to touch the screen at exactly the right time to enable your bird to pass through the pipes. And if you hit a pipe, if you touch it with your bird, then it's game over and you go back to start and start again. And it's incredibly difficult, very, very challenging. And, you know, lots of people kind of will get scores of like 3 or 4. You get some experts that are getting into the hundreds now. But, yeah, it's just this very, very, very simple systemic video game. And it's driven a lot of people mad, and now the creator of the game has pulled it from the app stores so that you can no longer get it.
Before we get into why it was pulled, tell me a little bit about what we know about the creator, Dong Nguyen.
Well, we know that he calls himself an indie developer. We don't know much about him. He's only made a couple of very small games before this. And those games didn't really betray too much of Flappy Bird's, what I think, Flappy Bird's kind of almost twisted genius. And so he created this game, and there's been lots, and it immediately took off. It sort of went viral, and in January it became such a big deal that he was apparently making $50,000 a day in advertising revenue from it, because it's a free-to-play game. So it just kind of became stratospheric in the shortest space of time. And immediately there were accusations and suspicions that he had been somehow using bots or to sort of cram the game up the Apple rankings. If you get enough people to review the games and you can get bots to kind of online bots to sort of fake reviews, then it managed to go up the rankings, then more people see it, and so more people can get hold of it. And there's been lots of suspicion about that, which I am in my kind of suspicious about those suspicions in a way. But anyway,
why would people be suspicious about that? It happens. How often?
Yeah, reasonably often. The thing is with app stores, and Charles will probably be able to talk about this as well, is that the massive problem that most developers have is visibility. There are so many games. I mean, I think it's something like 100 games a day going onto app stores, both on Android and on Apple, that it's very difficult to get your game noticed, however good it is. So in this kind of fake meritocracy, in a way, lots of people have to use weird efforts to get their games seen. And one of these is to use bots, is to use fake reviews, using lots of computers to generate reviews so that your game goes up the rankings and that you can be spotted on like the front page or at the top end of a search of the Apple search engine. So this does happen, but it's very difficult to sort of prove, and there's no proof that this is what Dong has done. And in fact, he's denied using anything like bots to improve the rankings of his game.
Charles, have you seen this kind of activity? I believe you, Keith. But Charles, like, how do other developers get their apps to the top?
There have been, I mean, certainly there's no evidence of anything around Flappy Birds, but there have been cases in the past where sites used to, this is a few years ago now, but the sites used to write to developers and say, hey, we'll give your app a favorable review if you give us some money, which is basically sort of app payola. But things sort of moved
cash
on, and
apps,
yes, and, but there have been certainly efforts to, for example, bundle games in apps and things, and sort of hope that you get more people downloading it as part of that. There have also been, yes, systems where people said, we'll get your game to rise up the rankings if you pass us some money, and no questions asked sort of stuff. So yeah, there is nefarious stuff going on. But as far as Flappy Bird goes, you could probably look at the rankings, look at the timings, if you really wanted to do some detective work on it, and figure out, did these come in a burst? Did they come from people who have reviewed other games? What is the pattern of the rankings? You could, if you really want to do the investigation, it's all out there. It's all public. But I suspect you just find people thought it was a really good game. And word of mouth is actually surprisingly effective in these sorts of things.
So, Keith, if this was one of the things that was levied at the developer of Flappy Birds, I mean, surely he could have just done what Charles said and turned around and said, oh, hey, hold on, here's the data. Why did he pull it? There was other negative publicity? He was getting threats? What was going on?
Yeah, and I think if we take him at face value, which I'm prepared to do, I'd rather do that than suspect otherwise. But he said, over the course of a few days on Twitter, he said that he's really found it difficult to cope with the sheer amount of attention the game has given him, but also a lot of the negativity online. It's, lots of the news reports into the game have spent a lot of time looking at how people have said it's ripped off the look of Super Mario. People have said it's stolen certain gameplay elements from older games. There's been this whole kind of language around the game where often, video games have progressed through borrowing ideas from each other. But with this game and with others like it, especially with casual games, this happens a lot with casual and free-to-play games, there's this really kind of nefarious, accusatory language around the game. And I think that's kind of maybe really depressed him. And also, there was a news story today, Forbes, the multinational media organization, managed to track him down and actually interviewed him in his hometown of Hanoi. And he said that he was worried about people becoming addicted to the game. That he never intended it to become so so difficult to stop playing, which kind of seems a bit weird to me, because the game is built on a very, very addictive compulsion loop. So I almost, you know, almost seems weird that he's created this and then suddenly thought, oh my goodness, what have I done? It's kind of like Frankenstein's Flappy Bird.
on the Guardian's website, Keith, you wrote a really lovely sort of deconstruction of a lot of the critiques that that was sort of levied at this game. But one of the things that really struck me was the fact that it seems as if indie gaming and casual gaming is the kind of last bastion of a kind of homage to the great heritage of computer gaming, the almost impossible difficulty levels, and you know how challenging and how addictive these early games were. Is that the case? Do you think that indie games are the last places that we can go to have, you know, sort of eye scratching out experiences, or you know?
Yeah, I think so, because if you look at mainstream games, very much the idea with a lot of games is that games are so expensive to produce now. I mean, they're as expensive to produce as films. So if you look at really, really big releases like Call of Duty or Grand Theft Auto or The Last of Us, they need to make a heck of a lot of money in order to get back that initial investment. And so they need to appeal to a casual user base. So lots of the big adventure games now are actually reasonably easy to finish. So you don't have that kind of real tough challenge. Games are no longer about the designer saying to you, "You cannot finish this game." It's about you will have a nice time while you're finishing this game. So yeah, with indie developers, they don't have that sense that they've got to recoup massive losses. They can still appeal to that hardcore, that minority of gamers that actually want to be almost sadistically challenged by their games. And one of the things I said in this feature is that this is actually, There's a whole kind of genre called the massocore genre in indie, which is about games that are almost impossible, and you have to learn complex systems. There's lots of trial and error. This is a whole genre of games, and we've seen this in quite big indie crossover hits, games like Super Meat Boy and I Want to Be the Guy. These are American games which have really exploited the idea of difficult compulsion loops. Whereas with Flappy Bird, there seems to have been this different response to it. And I can't help but feel that maybe some of it is that, you know, it's come from Vietnam, it's come from Southeast Asia, and this is an area we kind of, you know, we sort of fuzzily think of as somewhere which is known for counterfeiting. You know, I think this is part of the problem. There's almost a xenophobia attached to this game, I think. It's not being thought of in the same, it's not being critically evaluated in the same way as its peers.
Keith, thank you very much. I just wanted to close out this discussion by saying that even if you have not been able to get Flappy Birds, download it from the App Store or other available services. Samuel, eBay can provide, is that correct?
If you're absolutely desperate and you have something in the region of $90,000 to spend, you could. There, at least they were listed on eBay. I'm not sure whether the sales ever completed. People were basically selling smartphones preloaded with Flappy Birds, and Flappy Words was the selling point.
And you can read more of Keith's words on Flappy Birds' fantastic analysis of the phenomenon at theguardian.com/games. Hugh Hancock is fast making a name for himself as a director who can make a film as ambitious as Lord of the Rings on the budget of the Blair Witch Project. One of the pioneers of machinima, the art of making films inside virtual worlds, Hancock has managed to entice curious A-list stars, including Brian Blessed and Joanna Lumley, into World of Warcraft, voicing the key characters in his new film, Death Knight Love Story. Jemima Kish met up with Hugh earlier this week to discuss his work, how he's managed to be an indie in a world dominated by Pixar and the big studios, and to get some big-name actors to voice the characters too. Welcome today to Hugh Hancock, who is, well, executive producer and writer, director and editor of Death Knight Love Story. So for the uninitiated, tell us about machinima. What is this whole genre of films and kind of creative animation?
So back in 1996, you know, the prehistoric era as far as tech is concerned, when the computer game Quake, which was the sequel to Doom, came out, it was the first truly 3D game that you could run around in as a human. There'd been a couple of 3D games beforehand, but they'd all involved you being a spaceship or a weird octagonal thing on a moon. Quake was the first that let you be a person or something that looked like a person. And you could record games. You could record your games, so you could show them later and say to your friends, hey, look, this is where I blew you up with the rocket launcher, which was all very good fun. But some people figured out that by hacking those files and changing the angle of the camera, you could actually turn them into little mini films. The first film ever, first Quake movie, was called Diary of a Camper, and it was an epic tale of a guy who sat there and shot other people. But it showed that there was something spectacularly new you could do. People started developing much more complicated storylines. People started making their own mini TV series. And in about a year later, a guy called Hugh Hancock, who wanted to be a playwright or novelist, I hadn't really decided, happened to be playing a lot of Quake and got dragged in by people to write the story for their quote-unquote Quake movie because they knew I wrote those story things. And it was in the course of making this first little Quake movie that it became obvious what Machinima really was. Machinima is the using computer game technology, so real time, not pre-rendered, so not taking minutes to create a single frame, 25 frames a second, but seeing what you see is what you get, computer filmmaking. Often using the worlds or characters of computer games. And what this boils down to meaning is that a guy like me can create a film on the scale of major Hollywood blockbusters in his spare room, which also functions as his office. And this, I'm not the only person doing this. There have been hundreds and thousands of people all around the world making spectacular CGI blockbuster type films on tiny, tiny budgets, thanks to the miracle of Machinima.
Is this how you pitched it to Brian Blessed? Because the incredible thing about Death Knight Love Story is that you have Brian Blessed, Joanna Lumley, Anna Chancellor and Jack Davenport. How on earth did you get them on board?
It actually is pretty close to how I pitched it. I wasn't originally intending to try and get big name actors in at all. As I said, I intended... Death Knight Love Story was meant to be a test of motion capture technology because I'm obviously always looking to push the boundaries of what you can do with Machinima. And after I'd made a feature film in it and I went back and looked at it, and it was obvious that what it really needed was more natural human motion, more flexibility, more expression. And this was 2009 when motion capture technology was just getting to the point where independent game studios or independent filmmakers could afford to buy a studio. So I bought a motion capture system, which, you know, still had the traditional ping pong balls on the black suit and made you look very silly, but let you transfer human motion into a computer environment. Needed this test project, started it out, and was then chatting to a friend of mine, Chris Jones, who had just managed to get one of his short films onto the Oscar shortlist. And he was ranting about how Machinima filmmakers should really be trying to get big name actors because it's really interesting and because it's voice work. And I thought, what the hell, you know, I've got this film, I might as well make some calls, get told no and learn something. So I started with the casting agent. I started by looking up the biggest name I could find, you know, who lived in London, Gail Stevens, who she just cast Slumdog Millionaire. You know, Narnia, 28 Days Later, etc., etc., etc. Called her up and said, okay, so I've got this film and it's set in a computer game and it's using motion capture like Andy Serkis uses in Lord of the Rings and it's going to be distributed on the web. Are you interested in casting it? Expecting to get a very polite, thanks, but no. And what I actually got was, oh, that sounds really interesting. Can you come in next week?
It's making me wonder if do exciting stuff with new technology on the web is sort of on their strategy plan for the next few years. Was that how it felt?
I think what's going on is obviously entertainment is changing so fast at the moment. You've got Netflix, you've got performance capture. Avatar had literally just come out. Everyone was still talking about Gollum in Lord of the Rings 10 years earlier. No one knows what is going on with particularly filmic entertainment right now. I mean, that's always true. William Goldman says no and said no one knows anything. But it's more true than usual right at the moment.
How does the process differ to that of mainstream films? What are the benefits of doing a piece of machinima rather than the conventional kind of filmic approach of a regular film?
Well, you've basically got machinima is halfway between two conventional Hollywood approaches, and it combines the best bits of both. So It's obviously very similar in some ways to conventional animation, like Pixar's animation. We are not, I will say this right now, I am not as talented as John Lasseter or Brad Bird or anything like that. We are not that good, but we are using the same kind of technology. However, because all of it is rendered in real time as opposed to requiring hours to process each frame, it doesn't have the glacial slowness and the enormous number of people needed to make an animated film. And also, because we're working with a computer game world, we've essentially got this virtual backlot, which has, because the particularly a massively multiplayer world has to have the capability for thousands of people to tell their own stories and create their own characters, it has by definition to have enormous scope for telling stories in it. So we've also got all these sets and these characters, and so rather than taking the Pixar approach of painstakingly creating each one, which produces awesome work, but takes a very long time. I mean, we had to make two characters of our cast of 300-400 figures that you see in the film, and that took months and cost thousands. So we can location scout like a live action film. We can almost cast like a live action film because we can just create characters and say, is this guy right for the role? No. Okay, delete him, create another one. A process which I imagine real life actors are quite glad directors can't do. But on the other hand, we are working in a world that doesn't exist, which means we can do anything we like. If we want to turn gravity off, we can. If we want to stick a sword through someone, they're not going to object. We don't have to fake anything. We don't have to wait for the light to be right. If I want the light to be right, I type make light right into the console, and it is. The golden hour lasts all day.
Yeah.
So we can take a live action approach, particularly with the motion capture suits. We can take a live action approach. We can do it in stages, so we don't have to get it all right at the same time. With a live action shoot, the light's got to be right, the sound's got to be right, the camera's got to be right, the actors have got to deliver their best performance, and that's all got to happen at once, and that's why it takes so long. With us, we get the perfect performance, then we record the human motion, and I can just concentrate on directing the actors and getting the best performance without panicking and saying, is the sound boom in shot? Then I can move the camera around without having to worry because we've already got the great performances, add in the lighting. And so and that's the stuff that normally filmmakers say, oh, animators do that and I'm so jealous, but we can combine both sides.
How do you take this to a mainstream audience? And if you go to the Death Knight Love Story website, you can share it on Facebook, you can share it on Twitter.
Yeah.
But will this ever get to the stage where it's an accepted form of animation, of film, alongside all the formats that we're used to today?
I think there is no reason why it can't. Now, one issue, the reason why I'm not trying for a theatrical release for Death Knight Love Story is because it is explicitly a non-commercial project, and that's because of the fact we are using this game engine. Machinima has been dogged by legal issues. I mean, I know one guy who made an absolutely brilliant film. It's a comedy film, Male Restroom Etiquette. It's far more intelligent than the subject matter initially sounds. He was actually... There was a major Hollywood... The major US comedy show, I think it was the Jay Leno show, that wanted to screen that. But he couldn't do it because he couldn't get permission from the people who made The Sims, which was the game engine he used. There was a big wave a few years ago of Machinima filmmakers breaking out or looking like they were about to break out and then being held back by the legal issues. So in order for Machinima in the computer game-generated sense of Machinima to break out, it would have to get permission from the games companies. And obviously, they are very protective of their intellectual property.
Before you go, you have to tell us some really good backstage gossip for Brian and Joanna Lumley. They must have got up to some stuff, surely.
Brian is... I don't like the phrase larger than life. I really like the idea that most people, almost everyone, you know, everyone puts their trousers on one leg at a time. Having said that, not everyone age 72 when he did the recording, is telling stories in between takes about how he's trying to persuade Sir Ranulph Fiennes to go up Mount Everest again, and is saying that he was saying at one point that he'd been in training to go to the International Space Station. And they had put him in the centrifuge, and they could not get him to black out, no matter how fast they rotated the thing. He is genuine. He is the only person I've ever met for whom the occupational description of actor and adventurer is 100% appropriate. I thought the only adventurers were the ones, you know, inside World of Warcraft. But in some ways, Brian was so appropriate for the role, not least because he actually is an adventurer in real life.
Amazing. Hugh, it's been absolutely fascinating. Thanks so much for coming in and talking to Tech Weekly, and good luck with the reviews.
Thank you.
Staying with the Valentine's theme, but with a slightly darker twist, I think, Death Knight Love Story is online to watch now, and the best way to find it is by going to Hugh's website, strangecompany.org. That is it. That's all we have for you this week. Thank you so much for listening. Do recommend us to your friends, and do come back next Wednesday for another Tech Weekly. From me, Alex Kratosky, Tech Weekly producer Jason Phipps, and all the tech team here in the studio and elsewhere. Bye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.